Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and I live in Wichita, Kansas. I am a Patreon supporter for Creative Control. I discovered Creative Control some years ago, I think maybe while looking for interviews with Tommy Stinson of The Replacements. And I stumbled across this conversation that Vish had with Tommy Stinson that was really insightful. Vish held his own. I think Tommy can be a little bit of a difficult interview at times. And it went really well, and it really got into some areas that I wasn't expecting. And I thought, gosh, I have to listen to more of this guy and his podcast. Yeah, sometimes I'm not necessarily a fan of the music or musicians that Vish will have on the show, but I always appreciate their creative process a little bit more. And more times than not, though, it does lead me to finding a new musical artist that I'm interested in, or to think a little bit differently about maybe some artists whose work I've overlooked. So, you know, go ahead, and if you've been waiting at all to support Vish and Creative Control, now is probably the best time to do it. I know as a public radio employee here in Kansas, listener-supported broadcasting, whether it's podcasts or radio itself, really isn't a thing of the past. It's actually very much a thing of both the present and the future. So, yay Vish, yay Creative Control.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
When I was 10, I didn't have a single care and not a single body hair, and life was fine.
Robert Smigel is a renowned comedic writer, performer, director, producer, songwriter, and puppeteer based in his hometown of New York City. After making a name for himself in Chicago's improv and comedy community in the early 1980s, Smigel moved back home to work as a writer and occasional performer on Saturday Night Live, where he first began collaborating with friends like Conan O'Brien and Bob Odenkirk, all of whom would eventually create some of the most memorable talk show bits ever on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, including Smigel's enduring signature character, Triumph, the insult comic dog. After leaving SNL to work on film treatments and the short-lived but impactful Dana Carvey show in the mid-90s, Smigel created the SNL animated series TV Funhouse, which featured the ambiguously gay duo, and the now seasonal standard sung by Darlene Love, Christmas Time for the Jews. Over the past three decades, Smigel has worked closely with Adam Sandler on his various film and animation projects, including their latest movie together, a wonderful coming-of-age animated film called Leo, which Smigel co-directed, co-wrote, and performed in. For comedy nerds like me, Smigel is a pioneering and heroic figure, so I was very thrilled that we connected recently to discuss things like the making and story behind this hilarious film, Leo, why he rarely does podcasts, and also why he agreed to do mine, why kids know comedy better than some adults do, the popularity of the live reading of the Lost Hans and Franz movie that he participated in on Conan O'Brien's podcast earlier this year, and what that experience was like, why he loves writing songs while some people are afraid to promote films as musicals, singing well in character the way Triumph and Adam Sandler and Neil Hamburger do, critical acclaim and award season, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this donor-driven podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. By the way, for years I've been doing this show, and I mentioned the Patreon, and I, you know, it hasn't been that big a deal, but as I'm speaking to you, it's kind of a bigger deal now. I would like to, I need the money. And so if you can support me in doing this show as much of a full-time endeavor as possible, which I try to do, but now I really got to try to do it. I hope you can read between the lines here. Please support me at patreon.com/creativecontrol. It means a lot. Thank you so much. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and a very helpful website, blackbird.ca, where you can go and order records. I don't know if Leo, the soundtrack for the film Leo, I should say, is available on any kind of physical format, but if it is, if you go to blackbird.ca and type in Leo soundtrack, it might be there. And if they've got it, they can actually ship it to your house. If you can't make it to Edmonton or Calgary, Blackbird can help you out. Again, learn more at blackbird.ca. Plus, in-kind support from the likes of Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 829 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented and, for me, legendary Robert Smigel, with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
But that was then.
When I was 10.
Hi, Robert. How's it going?
Hey. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much for making time for me. I've been a longtime fan of yours, and it's a little unbelievable to me because I know you don't do a lot of, historically, you haven't done a lot of podcasts and interviews, no. But you're coming out of your shell, no pun intended, given what we're here to sort of talk about, one of the characters. What do you suppose is going on there? Are you just plugging a movie, or is something else happening that you're getting out there?
No, I mean, 90% of it is just plugging a movie. There are podcasts like Conan's and shows that I've just avoided doing because I just always feel silly just going on and talking about myself with no purpose other than to talk about myself. I'm more of a listener, to be honest. And I... But this is important. Now I have something that I've literally worked on for 4 years,
yeah,
which is the longest amount of time I've ever put into any project. And so, yeah, I want to make sure people know about it. And you know, as far as your podcast goes, you wrote a review of the movie, and it had a line in it that really struck me a lot. I'm the type of person who reads a lot of reviews. Sandler doesn't read any. I read like all of them in case, like, because I always think, oh, I might learn something about the movie, you know, something I could have done better, which hasn't really happened this time around. The reviews have been very good, and the ones that haven't liked it, I just think they're missing it. I don't think they get it. But your review, besides being a very nice positive review had this line, and I'll just read it.
Sure.
Song sequences give it a unique emotional tenor. Most here, where you say it tells a fantastical tale about being young and growing old, and how similarly strange, frightening, and joyous both things can be for everybody.
Yeah,
just such a unusual way to express the connection between young people and old people in this movie, yeah. In a way that I hadn't even thought about.
Wow!
But you know, it really resonated with me, and I thought it was beautifully expressed. So
wow.
I wanted to, I posted it to thank you, and then you asked me to do this. And I was like, what the hell?
I like, first of all, this is very flattering to me that a writer of your renown is focusing in on something that I wrote, I will admit, somewhat quickly. Like I write a lot, but I also don't write as much as I used to in this capacity, reviewing yeah. things. So it cool. means a lot to me. My family and I watched this film together. We loved it so much. So everything I said was heartfelt, and this is what occurred to me. Yeah. Secondly, right. I love the fact that you had to give a disclaimer as to why you're appearing on this podcast. Listen, everyone, this guy wrote a nice thing about me. I'm paying it forward. That's kind of you.
Well,
no, it's
well, because I mean, I like I said, I don't really like to do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm doing like, you know, some of the more high profile podcasts because I know that it's good for the movie.
Yes.
And yours, I wouldn't classify, don't be offended, but I wouldn't classify yours as one of the high profile podcasts.
That's correct.
So those are the kind of requests where I'm like, oh God, do I want to do this?
Yes.
But
yes.
I was, I just wanted to do yours because that piece of writing really stuck out and I figured, you must be an interesting guy.
Well, listen, I appreciate that.
Had interesting things to say.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate everything you said is accurate. namely that I'm interesting. No, I wanted to talk about Leo and I actually pulled the same quote because I wanted to ask you about why it resonated yeah. with you the way it did. You briefly articulated it. You said it hadn't occurred to you in this capacity. Let's expand upon that. What did it mean to you? What does it mean to you that I pointed out the songs and the tenor of the songs in particular mm-hmm. and how it might resonate with people of all ages?
Well, I think one song in particular probably it's maybe what you were thinking about more than the others was the one where the kids reminisce about how they were younger and mm-hmm. you know, and that comes from a place of like a comedic place at first because we're basically taking a joke that Charlie Brown probably made 50 years ago. Probably there's a strip somewhere where he says to his little sister, Sally, you have no idea what it's going to be like when you just wait till you're 8 years old, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a very Peanuts kind of sentiment. And I'm sure that joke has existed somewhere
yeah.
about a young kid thinking back to how simple his life was 2 years earlier. But yeah, that's the premise of this song. It's a bunch of 11-year-olds singing a song called When I Was 10.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the whole premise of the movie, as well as that song, came from a place of comedy. I just thought it would be really funny that these kids who have these kind of problems, like I have twin boys who were in fourth grade when I started this movie.
Yeah.
And I'm just acutely aware of kids that age and the oh my God stage and the smallest problems to adults seem like the biggest problems to these kids. And that's a starting point for comedy. And then juxtaposing their problems with this elderly lizard who's seen every type of kid in 75 years, comes from a very cynical place himself. For him to hear these minute little problems and then, but actually be able to, you know, conjure up a memory of a kid who had a similar problem and employ it that way, employ his memory by giving this new kid advice, that just struck me as funny. And then as I was writing the movie and that song, you just think about, you know, I became attached to the characters and more invested in their lives and getting into the heart of slightly more serious problems, like a kid who's a bully because he's very insecure about his intelligence, or a girl who bonded with her grandfather more than any other relative and is dealing with loss, you know? And so that's the arc of the movie, where Leo starts having a little more trouble giving advice, more complicated problems, and he kind of learns to listen. And that's still effective. And, you know, and the more invested he gets in the kids, the more he realizes that this is the most worthwhile thing he can do with the rest of his life. This is more valuable than any bucket list he had. And at the same time, in the song starts getting into, it starts with very silly memories like, you know, we still left milk for Santa Claus. My mom was not in menopause. And life was great when I was 8, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then as it continues, we see the girl reminisce about her grandpa, even though it's comedic. My grandpa and my gerbil were still alive. And then the next boy talks about how a haircut used to make him cry more than people dying. Like, mm-hmm. he actually sings, I didn't care that people die. And that's something, I don't know if that's common, but, you know, I have 3 sons, and my twin boys, when they were 4 or 5 years old, they kind of laughed at the concept of death. They just thought it was weird. And
yeah, abstract.
Yeah. Abstract, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then when they were 8, my dad passed away, and, you know, he had had a long, beautiful life and a long, painful illness. So there was a part of me that felt relief. And it really wasn't until one of my sons got on the phone, having just heard about it, and he was crying so, you know, much more than I'd heard him cry in years. And it was very touching, because he was absorbing not just that he loved his grandfather, but just that he was coming to terms with mortality,
yeah,
at that age. And that was very moving. And that's like the first time, and that's what really got me crying at that moment. And that's just a moment that I remembered and put into the song, you know. And it's,
yeah.
And so, yeah, so the movie to me was about how much we need each other, and how, you know, kids need to be able to share their anxieties and not keep them to themselves.
Yeah.
They need to find someone that they can trust. And then on the flip side, from Leo's perspective, it's about having a purpose in life beyond glamorous stuff. Those are always my favorite movies anyway. Like, those movies always get me, like Up and It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Know, movies that, where the message of the story is just to have friends and connect with people, and that an adventure with someone you love, even if it's mundane, if you really love that person, that's a more meaningful adventure than doing glamorous things. You know, so that to me is what the movie is. It's about how much we need each other. So what you wrote was just an observation that I hadn't connected with yet, which was the concept of, you know, the idea of how being young and growing old. I didn't connect that, how similar they can be in certain ways, how scary they can be, and how strange they can be.
Yeah.
Because growing old, I mean, I'm starting to, but I'm not at that point where I'm like really, where I'm really falling apart and coming to terms with that every day of my life. That'll be in the distant future, I hope, but it'll happen,
yeah,
God willing.
Yeah.
And you know, the connection between the scariness and strangeness of that and the scariness of strangeness of being like 10 and knowing that you're on the cusp of young adulthood, and you've been so comfortable in your skin as a child all that time, that's really, that was just really interesting to me that Leo and the kids had more in common than I had even thought about.
If I step back and take a kind of whatever academic perspective on the film and I ponder what you've just talked about, I think what resonated with me and my family, I would guess anyway, is that this film offers perspectives on change and dealing with change and how much life is about those changes and how profound they can be. But it's also very hilarious because you invoked the young girl in the film who had a close relationship, I believe, with her grandfather. And yes. I believe that's the character who can't stop crying, right?
That is the character who, well, she starts crying during, she inspires that song, Don't Cry.
So that song, I watched this film with a couple of 40-year-olds, myself and my wife, 40-odd-year-olds. Yeah. By the way, it's my it's my birthday today. I'm 40.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm 46.
Way to go.
I'm entering this realm you're talking about, looking back, looking forward, whatever. So I'm, I watched it with my wife and a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old, and nothing made them laugh harder than Leo singing the Don't Cry song. And
I think that's the funniest moment in the whole movie.
Is it? Okay. So
I think it is.
Yeah.
That and the scene where Squirtle gives bad advice to the bully, I think is up there too. But I think, and a few things the drone do are very funny, but,
yes,
but
that's right.
I would say, and you know, it was very gratifying because that was a very heavily criticized song when we were making the movie. But every time people would screen it in front of an audience, it would get enormous laughs.
It's a laugh
from kids too.
Yeah, it's a laugh
from kids too.
It's a disbelief laden laugh. Like my son, who's getting more attuned to satire, and my daughter too. Like, I can't believe this lizard is making fun of his situation. And to see that recognition of satire and comedy in my children. Sorry, Robert. Every Friday we have family movie night and we've been peppering things in that make sense for everyone and won't be over their heads. By the way, I don't recommend Jaws. I had to shut that down. I don't know what I was thinking on Jaws.
How old were they?
They're 8 and 12. And it was a big mistake.
Ooh.
Yeah. I'm a good parent.
12. My kids could, I have two boys, and my wife, I don't know how she did it, but she loves horror movies, and she had these kids. In a way, it almost like they built up an immunity by watching them young. They watched The Shining.
Oh, my God.
And I played Jaws for them when they were about 11, and they loved it.
Well,
they loved Jaws.
It's the 12 and the 8-year-old. So my father... My parents immigrated from India. My dad in the early 80s got himself one of the first VCRs. And he had one of the movies he rented, and we would tape the movies off the TV as well. So one of the movies he taped, or the first movie he rented, I think, was Raiders of the Lost Ark. So I was, 4 or 5 years old. That's a little overwhelming. Great. Nazis and melting faces, and it's bonkers. But then Jaws was on, and I watched it when I was 6 years old. And to this day, I can't swim. I don't like the water. And I think
it
there's something
you that much.
I don't think that necessarily. I wouldn't say there's a direct correlation. I'm just telling you, I'm not buoyant. If I try to swim, I just sink and I'm a little scared of the water. I'm just a little bit scared.
Wow.
So I agree with you. And I they told me, no, 5 minutes in, we got to pick a different movie. We can't watch Jaws. I gave them a big speech. Look, unlike some of the movies, sharks are real. But this is still a movie. Like, you don't have to worry. But it was bad. Otherwise, I'm a great dad. I hope I like to think I'm a good dad. And I helicopter a little bit. I worry about them. And yet, here I am showing them Jaws. So all this to say, it's been really fun showing them different films and seeing how they process humor and intellectual
and
stuff.
They're smarter than people give them credit for.
Well, this is a film that I think... You're entering an age, you and I are both at an age where we have children, which means we have to go to their schools for events and meet with their teachers. I'm sure you go through this. You don't regress, but you end up putting yourself back in their shoes.
Absolutely.
As kids, right? Right.
Of course.
So this movie is really, if I may encapsulate it beyond the brilliant review I wrote The profound statements I included in it.
I don't know how you're going to go beyond that review, but let's give it a shot.
No, all I'm getting at is, and now I lost what I was going to say. I think it's putting yourself in other people's shoes.
Yeah.
In so many ways. And there's definitely my wife, who is a big fan of teachers, thought this was an interesting analysis of the relationship that teachers have with students. So you got your parents. You got Leo, who is essentially a lizard trained by teachers, because a lot of his wisdom comes from observing kids and their behavior, but he's also been through a lot of teachers. What do you suppose are you saying something particularly profound, do you think, about the art of teaching, the act of teaching students, and how important that role is?
Well, there's a song that's kind of, you know, normally when I write stuff, I almost never try to tell. I never try to indicate. If someone is saying something and there's a moral behind it, I'd never like to state that moral.
Yeah.
And I probably would have made more popular cartoons if I had once in a while, because like South Park always did that. They would always have Kyle or somebody, like they'd do the crudest half hour, and then at the very end, Kyle would kind of explain what the premise of what the writers were going for. And I always felt like I want people to just figure it out. But in this movie, I figured for kids, I'm going to make a couple of things very clear. Like I did at the end when he says, find your Leo. I really wanted kids to understand that everybody's scared and that they shouldn't feel like they should keep anything to themselves. I just thought it was important for kids to hear that directly. And then when he has his moment with Ms. Malkin, the grumpy teacher, it's not quite as straightforward, but he kind of steers her into understanding the inherent gift of being an effective mentor, which is what Leo's learned.
Yes.
You know, and he says that there were other substitute teachers who, you know, they treated kids like they were their family, and that's why they were happy, because they connected emotionally. They let go of themselves enough to connect emotionally with those kids, you know, and nurture them and be vulnerable. And that's why they were not just happy teachers, but effective teachers. And so, there's supposed to be a message in the movie that the inherent value, not just of mentoring, but specifically for teachers too, to be celebrated for that.
Teachers can learn too. Like my wife said this, I'm like, yeah, but, and I don't want to spoil anything. If you think about it, the main villain in the film was also kind of was a teacher. So it's an interesting comment on what teachers can learn.
Yes, I don't consider her a villain any more than I consider the dad in Mary Poppins a villain.
Right.
He was an impediment.
An oppositional force.
Exactly. He becomes, Mary Poppins is an agent of change, just like Leo is in this movie.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Although Leo changes as well, just like Mary Poppins does by the end of that movie. But Leo, I've always liked movies that don't have absolute clear bad guys. Like even when we did Hotel Transylvania, which is a story that I inherited, the first one anyway, you know, I did a big rewrite on it, but it was essentially the bare bones of the story were there already. And I like the fact that Dracula was an impediment, and he was not a bad guy. He was someone who needed to learn. And
also a dad who needed to learn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
By the way, I just realized this. We watched Hotel Transylvania because my daughter finds things on Netflix that she thinks are appealing. And my son has become a Sandman fan. Just letting you know, that's hilarious that you mentioned that. And I happen to know that the dad in Hotel Transylvania is struggling with their child coming of age and what that means, right? So, agents of change. So I think I maybe hit on something when I suggest this is a film all about changing. And I think you're aligned with that. It's all about these life changes.
Well, yeah, you're looking at it from like just inherent life changes, which is really interesting that old people and young people at these ages are sharing that. And that means mostly I'm talking about Leo, not Ms. Malkin, but
yes.
And, you know, and I'm talking more about the classic agents of change in movies like Mary Poppins.
Yes. Where, yes. Yeah. Yeah. But I do think, as I don't want to dwell on it too much longer, but I do think, sorry, I'm just patting myself on the back. This whole interview is me excited. I'm talking to Robert Smigel.
That's all
patting
good. Myself.
No, I think that's a fundamental thing. Kids are staring down in grade five as you graduate, staring down momentous change on
yeah.
in a different way as you get older. If you're Miss Malkin or a senior like Leo, you're facing the ultimate change. And what are you going to do with the time you have left before you change, I guess, is a way of looking at it, right?
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting for anybody who's listening, who watches the movie, if you stay and if you click on Netflix to play the closing credits, beyond the animation credits, and you skip all the way to the end of the rolling credits, there's a little bonus piece of animation, a storyboard
yeah.
that existed for a part of the song that we ended up cutting out of the movie. It's in the soundtrack. And the last line of it's the opening song in the movie. And the last line is last year and what we do in grade five will decide the rest of our lives. Like, it's just over paranoid about.
That's another thing.
Important.
Everyone thinks yeah. everything that's coming up might be more important than it is. Maybe you can
relax
a little bit. You, I think, are having a great year. In general, from my perspective, because one of the highlights of the year for those of us who consume podcasts or go on YouTube is the Lost Hans and Franz movie live reading
yes.
that you did.
Yes.
Now, for people who don't know, actually, Robert, what do you want to explain what happened there? What was going on?
Sure.
Yeah.
So Hans and Franz, for people who are younger than 50.
46.
Or younger.
40,
younger than 46.
I grew up with Hans and Franz for sure.
Okay, yeah. So yeah. let's say younger than 40.
Yeah.
Hans and Franz were characters created by SNL performers Dana Carvey and Kevin Nealon in 1986. And in the 80s, there was a huge fitness craze. And Arnold Schwarzenegger was a part of that. And he was a gigantic action star in the 80s. And, you know, Arnold has an Austrian accent. And this was a sketch hosted by two men who professed to be Arnold's cousins, Hans and Franz. And they were these muscle-bound idiots who were Jake Steinfeld was a very popular bodybuilding advisor at the time. So they had their own bodybuilding show, which was basically berating the viewer by presuming that they're too lazy to work hard. And it's like, you know, we could easily tie your love handles into a knot and hang you from a bridge with your flab, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they became very, very popular characters on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And like almost everything on SNL, when something becomes popular, somebody wants to make a movie about it. And in this case, the person who wanted to make a movie about it was Arnold Schwarzenegger himself. He was like, guys, let's make a movie. And you go to Hollywood and you meet me and all that. And so Dana Carvey and Kevin Nealon came to me with this idea. And I was like, oh, that's a terrible idea. Because I just thought these guys are so one-dimensional. That could never work. But
right.
then I thought, well, what if we make that a musical? So that'll kill like 20, 30 minutes. And then we can then spend less time on the story. And then I realized, like, well, the second half of the movie, once they're in California, can be dominated by Arnold, and it'll be a big parody of his Hollywood career, and it will just make it really silly and make him obsessed with muscles and
buttocks.
And so, yeah. And so we wrote the movie. I added, you know, I started writing it with Kevin, and then I had Conan jump in and help as well, and Dana threw in, and I've written many silly movies since then, all of which have not gotten made, many of which were SNL-based. I made a Chicago Da Bears Superfans movie with Bob Odenkirk. I made an ambiguously gay duo movie with Stephen Colbert. I wrote a whole other movie about a character Adam used to play where he would stand up from the audience and go, "Don't you see? Don't you understand? We love you for who you are, Pat." Anyway, I wrote a movie for that guy that was a horror movie. But the Hans and Franz movie was just a blissfully ridiculous script and experience. And we loved it so much, had so much fun writing it. But the studio thought it was ridiculous. And then Arnold, but we still thought we could get it made if Arnold would do it. But he made the movie Last Action Hero in the interim.
Oh.
While he was waiting to make this one. And I was told by his manager, a guy named Lou, he said, "Arnold, he's afraid to do this now." It was like he created a new rule, like, "I can never play myself in the movie again." Because The Last Action Hero was very self-referential. And I thought it was a pretty good movie, actually, but it was a bomb.
It bombed and was critically reviled for some reason, yeah.
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 And, you know, all these movies are a source of frustration. You know, you think talking to me, I'd be like, "Oh, I got a great career going." But some of my favorite things that I've ever written have never seen the light of day.
Right.
And the Hans and Franz movie was one of them. And now you've seen at least parts of it. And a lot of people agree with us.
Yeah.
That it is one of the funniest things we've written. And that's kind of empowering and makes me feel like I want to just do a podcast where I just do table reads of everything I've ever written and assume that they're all as good as the Hans and Franz movie.
At one point, Dana Carvey, early in the podcast that you guys did, this series, he says he wonders if Arnold will ever hear this, that you guys are doing reading. And then Arnold heard it and he appeared on Conan.
Yeah.
And he said he really liked it. What did you make of that?
Oh, I wasn't surprised. He has a great sense of humor, and I always thought that he would have been great in the movie if he had just pulled the trigger and had it. And I think it would have been an incredible movie. It would have been a blast. He used to appear on Saturday Night Live periodically with Hans and Franz, and he was always incredibly funny. I remember when he met them, I think they told us that the first thing he said to them was, "Okay, so how do I do the accent? You know, fellas, how do I do it?"
He seems very funny and self-effacing, unlike most action stars who...
Yeah, I mean, if you think about his journey, coming from Austria and making it, trying to be an actor and then making it as a bodybuilder and with that accent and managing to be an actor. And I think he understands how hilariously unlikely his journey has been and has a sense of humor about it in that regard.
Yeah. During the taping, you guys joke, I guess, sort of about how you wish Arnold would participate in at least a live reading, like not just
did. That would be my dream, would just do a full live reading of it. Not that I didn't have fun playing Arnold on that.
Brilliant. Brilliant performance as Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, I had forgotten how many lines Arnold had. Like by the third and fourth chapter of that podcast, 90% of the script was just me doing long speeches as Arnold and then Kevin and Dana going, "Yah, yah." It was like everybody's watching the least famous guy now.
But could something, do you think something else? Like that, I think, unless I'm crazy, this was popular. The thing you guys did.
Oh, no. Ever since then, I keep hearing, you got to make it an animated film or,
something.
I was thinking, what if we did it with AI, and had a young Arnold and a young Kevin and Dana? But really, I would just be happy if we could do a live reading for charity and, split it between Arnold's charity and my autism charity. That would be a dream come true for me.
Well, I hope it happens.
We'll see.
I hope
I do
happens.
Too.
So getting back to Leo, at one point, you alluded to this just now, at one point in the podcast with Conan, you say what you just said, that you originally thought of Hans and Franz, you thought it could be a musical. What is it about musicals and songs? People think of you as a cartoonist, I suppose, a writer, a puppeteer, but you clearly love to sing and write songs.
I do.
So what was it about... What is it about the musical, not just Hans and Franz, let's go to Leo as well. Because I will tell you, and I know Stephen Colbert said this exact same thing to you. When I pressed play on Leo, I did not realize it was a musical.
Yeah.
And we had to be like, oh, it's a musical. Oh, okay. Yeah. The third song in, this is happening. It's a musical. So what is it about the musical form that resonates with you as a comedic writer?
Well, it's interesting. First, all these movies are hiding that they're musicals. Wonka, Mean Girls, if you look at any of their trailers, even Frozen did it, I was told. Hmm. It was like they just reassured us. Oh, even Frozen, when it came out originally, their first trailers hid that it was a musical. Apparently, there's like enough people who just have such a prejudice against even investing in a musical for a second. And we actually shortened the opening song partly because... Like when people are trapped in a theater, it's one thing. But if you have the opportunity to turn away on Netflix, there was concern that like, oh, if the opening song's too long and we wait too long before we get to Leo, people are going to tune out. So we shortened the song for that reason.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, but I've just always had an affinity toward... Not that I'm talented at it, but I've just loved making up songs. Like when I was a kid, I would make fun of friends three different ways. I would either draw cartoons of them, or I would imitate them, or I would write songs about them, like little jingles. And they wouldn't be long songs, but they would be catchy and stupid. And I was obsessed with theme songs as a child. Like I would watch certain superhero shows like Spider-Man. I would just watch for the theme song and then I would turn away to some other show.
Right.
Because I wasn't really into superheroes, even though I made a living parodying them on SNL for a few years.
Also a great, great superhero theme song, the Ambiguously Gay Duo, is it's in my head.
Fighting all
It's never going to leave my head. It's just in my mind. It's stored there. Brilliant.
No, I wrote that. I wrote Saturday TV Funhouse.
Yes.
TV Funhouse. Those, and then Christmas Time for the Jews and
massive holiday favorite. What do you made a holiday classic standard with Christmas Time.
Some people say that it is. Darlene Love, the real hero of that song is Stephen Gold, the arranger, because he made it sound exactly like a Phil Spector wall of sound.
Yes.
He did an amazing job with like no musicians, no budget. So
yeah,
I still don't know how he pulled it off, but he did. And Darlene Love just performed at my, autism benefit, and I got to talk to her about it. Yeah, she would love to sing it again, but she doesn't know how to do it in concert without the cartoon behind her. So
wait a minute, had you never talked to her about it since it came out like so many years ago?
I mean, not since we recorded it in 2005.
Oh wow,
it's the first time. I haven't seen her in like 18 years until Monday night when we did the Night of Too Many Stars.
Robert, are you circulating more than you usually do? You're doing podcasts. You're talking to Darlene Love. You're making movies. This is a big year.
It's all like waiting for the bus and they all come at once because, I mean, we were going to do a Night of Too Many Stars in 2020 and the pandemic hit.
Oh, right.
And I was also going to cover the 2020 election as Triumph like I did in 2016. And, you know, it's just ended up that this has been all I've done for the most part professionally in the last 4 years. I've done a few podcasts as Triumph and very little else.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it just so happened to time out the Night of Too Many Stars that we were finally getting to do another one in, you know, at the end of 2023. But Leo came out the same time. So, yeah, everything's overlapping. And Darlene was nice enough to do this to open the show for us. So, I got to talk to her. But, you know, I do love songwriting, even though I can't play a musical instrument. I just sing songs into a, you know, garage band or, you know, a similar app. And then someone talented arranges it. You know, I mean, it's still my melody, but they chart it and make it something that can be played for human consumption.
Well, this is a nice segue into your long relationship with Adam Sandler, arguably one of the most successful musical comedians of all time. So,
yes, and his style of songwriting influenced me a little bit in this one. Like, to be honest, when I took this gig, and even though the lizard thing was my idea, I knew I was going to run with the first draft for the most part, but I did think, well, ultimately I'll write these songs with Adam. But then I just kind of got on a roll and did them on my own, and Adam liked them. But they were definitely influenced in terms of just focusing on, like, keeping them tight, keeping them filled with jokes, and not going a second longer than they need to. A lot of times, if you see Adam's stand-up act, he'll do a bunch of songs, but a lot of them aren't like full-length songs where it's got to be like verse, chorus, verse, verse, chorus, bridge. You know, he'll do as much as the song needs. And that's how I think of this movie as more of like a comedy with songs than a musical comedy.
Sure.
Because a lot of the songs, they serve their purpose for as long as they need to, and then they get cut off by something. A door opens, or Leo tells the kid to shut up, or some songs are just incredibly short, like the drone song.
Yeah.
You know, there are like two songs, I think, in the whole movie that are start to finish full songs, and they're my favorite songs, Don't Cry and When I Was 10.
Yeah.
But that's it. I don't think there's any other song that's a full song. When It's Us in the closing credits is another one, I suppose, but that's it.
So Sandler is the voice. He's got and I'm not being silly here, I think he's got a great voice and a dynamic voice to sing the material he has sung in his career in character with an accent, with a voice. I think that's harder than maybe people realize. Like, he's singing really well and in a voice. So there's that part of it. What's that?
I don't know if it's harder. In a way, it's a crutch. Like, because I did a whole album as Triumph.
Right, that's true.
Like, in 2003, I wrote a whole album, Come Poop With Me, with a lot of filthy songs. And I sang them all in character.
Right.
It was all Triumph singing. And in a way, it was easier. It, like, almost took the pressure off. You have a little more leeway in terms of, like, you can be pitchy a couple of times here and there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I still sang the songs pretty well, but I had more license to be imperfect when I was singing. And I think Adam does too. There are moments in Don't Cry or his solo song about, you know, Lizard's Lament. When a man has to face that one. There's like it's not like sung note by note perfect, but it shouldn't be almost. It's like,
right. Yeah. I just had a fellow on named Greg Turkington. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He plays a character named Neil Hamburger. Yeah. And he just created this one. He was just on the show. Also, I will say, doesn't do podcasts often, if at all, but we have a nice dynamic, and he comes on the show when he can. And,
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Robert, I'm okay. I'm a good person. People like me. I'm cool. The show's good. Anyway, my point is this. He sang this beautiful, if you haven't checked out Seasonal Depression Suite, I think you would love it, Robert. It's a beautiful, my kids, again, I worry sometimes about the content, if they really get it, but they love the satire of this album. It's a concept record set in a chain hotel. Guests, Neil Finn from Crowded House, relatives of Frank Sinatra, a whole bunch of brilliant people, Bonnie Prince Billy, they all sing songs on it with Neil Hamburger. It's great. So I recommend that to you.
But sorry,
it's
another the name example. Of the album again is?
Seasonal Depression Suite.
Seasonal Depression Suite. Is it a recent album?
Yeah, it just came out a month ago or something like that.
Oh, very cool. I'll absolutely look it up.
I'll send you a link if that helps.
And I'm not surprised again about your kids. It's like I was saying, kids, you know, everybody says this, that they're smarter than you give them credit for, but it's not even just that. It's just they're more observant than you give them credit for.
Yeah. Yeah.
They understand, like, I knew people were telling me, you got too much stuff here with the parents and the teachers. Keep it. It's a kid's movie. Focus on the kids. And I'm telling them, my kids recognize when a parent is being a bully.
Yes.
My kids recognize when a parent is acting like they're entitled to something that they're not.
Yes.
They recognize when a teacher is insecure about their control over the classroom and then they lash out.
Yeah.
This, and I'm not talking about like now at 15, I'm talking about when they were 9 years old. They recognize these things.
No,
I had conversations about them.
Yeah.
And so I knew that kids would not tune out when we did these moments. I just believed it.
Yeah. And that's why I press play on things for them. I trust them. I'm just, what I'm getting at is I'm surprised at the nuance they pick up on, but you're right. At this point, I shouldn't be. I have a lot of love and respect for my kids, and I think they do get stuff. So, watching Leo with your family, I will tell people, not just to upsell it, it's fun. It's fun to watch it with a range of ages because it's one of these films where I think different demographic, age demographics, if you will relate to it. So I want to.
No, it's very special that way. I do believe that, there's a lot in it for people of different ages. And I don't think, you know, it's not one of those movies where it's a kid's movie that has like pop culture references for adults that are like little winks. Okay, you bored? Here's a joke for you. No, it's all character-based stuff that's organic to the story. And that's why I think it resonates. It's not just funny to adults, but it really resonates with adults and obviously with kids. And Adam and I, you know, when people asked us, what do we want to bring to kids' movies? Like, one of the things is laughter, like, for kids. Because I feel like there's a million great animated movies out there that I love, Pixar movies, that tell beautiful stories and are touching and entertaining. But they're not necessarily, like, laugh-packed.
Yeah.
Even though I love, like, a movie like Coco, one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years.
Oh, boy. But it made us all cry, Coco. I will tell you that.
Yeah, it makes me cry. And Up is obviously
opening sequence. Yeah, opening sequence is a tear.
Well, everybody cries at the opening sequence. For me, it's when he opens the book at the end and he finds that extra line that he never saw that she wrote.
Yeah.
That gets me more than almost anything in any movie.
Yeah.
But these are amazing movies, but they're not like wall-to-wall laughs. And so Adam and I, you know, we come from comedy. And when we wrote Hotel Transylvania and we went to screenings and the kids are laughing all the way through, we're like, okay, I don't care what the critics think, if they think this is like a slight movie or a dumb premise. We're happy because we hear the sound of kids laughing from start to finish in this movie. And you know, maybe Despicable Me, maybe a couple other movies are like that. But no, it's not common in these kids' movies. A lot of them are as much for adults as they are for kids.
I think because you and Adam both represent, for some people anyway, edgier comedy, sometimes juvenile comedy. The poignancy of your work is lost a little bit. Like we watch Happy Gilmore as a family too at some point. And you're great in that. Adam's great in that. But it is ultimately quite absurd and silly. But there's a moral center to it. A guy wants to make good, help his family, and I think that's sometimes that gets lost for critics. I don't think the general audience you joking about how Leo was doing on Rotten Tomatoes, and you referred to what'd you call it? The Adam Sandler curve or something like that?
The Happy Madison Bell curve?
Yeah, that's right. So you seem very self-aware of how you're perceived, you and Adam and your...
For that movie, that it was a 77 at that time. Now it's up to 81, which I call the bandwagon effect. You know, the late coming critics are like, oh, wait a minute. Okay. So this movie doesn't suck. Okay. And that's what they're starting from.
Yeah.
They're starting from that place.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's definitely, you know, and now people are talking about awards and we didn't get a Golden Globe nomination or whatever. I never care about awards. I feel like we've won. We have a successful movie and
yeah,
that's all we really need.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the people who are bummed about it, that's, I think some of that is still lingering Happy Madison bell curve yeah. stuff. Like, oh, well, this is not an award worthy. I mean, Adam should have had a couple of Oscar nominations by now just as an actor. I mean, for at least for Uncut Gems and for Punch Drunk Love, at least those two.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, so people, whatever. It's like, it's so random and that I just, it's one of the reasons I just beg people not to get caught up in winning awards or even being nominated and just like focus on the miracle that we get to make movies and that this one worked and that we'll,
you know, this is exemplified. I don't know if you're still close with him. Bob Odenkirk's work on Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
That show, I've rewatched that show. Sorry. I've watched and rewatched that show twice this year, beginning to end, because I love it so much.
Wow.
Yeah, I've managed to find, it was one of those things where instead of flipping around, I would just watch chunks of episodes while I was eating a bowl of cereal or whatever. Just because I love it so much. But that's an example of someone in a cast doing something I've never seen before. And the storylines are so intricate, they get almost completely shut out at award season. And that to me is an example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, the show gets shut out a lot too. Bob's been nominated a number of times, but he hasn't won. But it's like,
who cares?
Who cares? He got to do it. And years from now, no one's going to remember. I always use Seinfeld as an example.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, just the fact that Jason Alexander never won an Emmy Award.
It's crazy.
Is reason enough to just understand that none of it means anything.
Yeah.
Because like, I can't pick an actor who deserves recognition any more than Jason does for playing George Costanza. Has there ever been a funnier performance on television?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And he's great as Dr. Skin, if I might say as well. If people are paying attention to his performance in
Thank
that,
you.
Yeah, he's great.
Yes. Well, I love Jason and I've met him a few times. I got to write the You Like It, a Juice sketch on Saturday Night Live with Jason in it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that's when I met him, and we've been in contact ever since. So I called him up to do the Dr. Skin character. But yeah, I mean, I feel like these things, they're great for promotion awards. I understand why they exist. But other than that, their biggest purpose is to make like 97% of the creative community feel inadequate.
Yeah.
Feel like no matter how you've made Better Call Saul and now this thing has to exist that makes you feel somehow unappreciated and like who cares?
I think for the audience you want to think that you devoted your time to a winner. Like there's just a little bit of psychology. I don't care. I'm telling you this right now. I'll watch that old goddamn show for a third time by the end of this year. I think it's great.
Yeah.
But my point is I think psychologically you want to think that the time you spent needs to be validated by the Academy of some kind. That's all it is.
But listen,
it doesn't
matter.
When
people think of sitcoms, what do they think of first? Seinfeld or Frasier?
Yeah, Seinfeld.
It's not even close.
Yeah.
It's not even close. And Seinfeld, Frasier won like 10 of these things. Seinfeld may have won a couple.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very random and arbitrary and subjective and any negative word that you want to use that will discount their importance. I don't think that they shouldn't exist because I think it's great to promote great television and movies, but I don't think people should get wrapped up in them. I just you got to have perspective and realize that you've won just by getting to make the project, and then you've really won if people like the project. So I couldn't be more – I've never even had anything like this happen to me where I've made something for the masses that everybody liked at the same time. Like Hotel Transylvania didn't get great reviews. Zohan didn't get great reviews, even though they were popular movies. And then I've had like, oh, so many TV projects that, you know, Dana Carvey show, that they're all these projects that like look well, where it's like everybody celebrates it 10 years later, you know? And
well, I will tell you, in the box I have of the very, somewhere down in my basement, I recorded Conan's first late night show. Just, I didn't know who he was, but I love late night. I love Letterman. So sure. I thought I better grab this, and then became a lifelong fan. I don't know if you can see it. I actually have a poster of Conan right up there from
there you go. Yeah.
The Legally Prohibited from Being Funny on Television tour 2010.
Yes.
And also on one of those VHS tapes, which if I had a player, I'd watch it. I think every episode of the Dana Carvey show. Something about me at that age. Yeah. What year is that? 91, 92? What is that?
Carvey was 96.
96. Conan, oh my God. Okay.
Conan started in 93. 93.
So I'm like 96. I'm 18, 19. And I was plugged in to what was going on. And I that's how I know Colbert and Carell and, and you and all these guys. So all I'm getting at is it's just very significant to me that you're here. I'm mindful of the time. I want to ask you about Sandler and Conan, but I have to go and I feel badly because I got kids to get and all that kind of stuff. So that's maybe great. If you pop your head up again someday to do podcasts and around podcasts, I hope we can reconnect. But I, in sort of conclusion, and to be respectful of your time as well, I just want to ask, what's next? You're riding this high of 2023. You're conquering. You're the prince of all media, at least. So what's next for you?
I don't have a definitive plan. I have certain ideas for projects that I'd like to do. I would love to cover the election as triumph, at least some of it. I don't know if that's going to happen either.
I find it. So, I mean, was it strange or surreal to you to be making the rounds promoting Leo as Triumph the Insult Comic Dog? Like, is that ever odd?
That's just how it works. It's like, yeah, we'd love to have him on. Can he do Triumph too? And you know what? It's like, it's fun. I don't mind at all. It's, you know, Triumph is, I don't even look at Triumph as myself anymore, because I have people helping me write jokes, and I'm just honored to get to do Triumph and make people laugh with that ridiculous character.
I have to say it was surreal. You and I connected over a social media platform for this, and I was like, every once in a while, I'm like, I'm actually communicating with Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, because like, that's what it doesn't say your name. It says Triumph.
I don't have a. I just go with the Triumph. I hide behind Triumph. I identify myself when it's me.
I feel you often hide. If I think about the Lips character on Conan, it was you, and we knew it was you, those who followed you, but we couldn't see your face. Triumph, we don't see you. This animated stuff, we don't see you. Like, you're a background, you think of yourself as a background guy.
I just think I fell into that, and I'm perfectly happy with that. There's something very comfortable about getting to do all this fun stuff without having to be recognized.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed that. I have to be honest with you. I've enjoyed bringing my kids up without being a full out celebrity, you know, and having to be stopped everywhere. And, you know, at the same time, I'm like a little bit famous enough that they understand that, you know, I get to do cool things and that they get to have fun with me as a result sometimes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it hasn't, you know, all I've ever cared about is power. It sounds ridiculous, but
the power to be able to make the things you want to make.
Yes, because that's where my ego really focuses on, not on myself, but on my work. I love my own ideas.
I'm going through the same thing right now. I'm going through the exact same thing right now. And I don't have the ideas you have, but I just wish I could do this and not have to worry about a day job or anything else. And I'm struggling as I'm speaking to you. Yeah, it's a tough one. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that's the thing. So, you know, when I get recognition for doing, whether it's this movie or Triumph or my cartoons, whatever it is, I'm much more interested in where it's going to lead than in just any kind of self-satisfaction that people know me and like me. That's fun. I'm not going to deny it.
Yeah.
We're all in this to make people, you know, laughs are usually enough for me, just hearing people laugh. But if people come up to me and say, oh, I was having hard times and the first time I laughed in X amount of months was from a triumph thing, well, that makes me feel fantastic, you know.
Well, your contributions are greatly appreciated by people like me, and they have been for a long time. So, Robert, I don't want to get too emotional, but it's just very kind. It's kind of you to make time for me. Obscure person up in Canada, and it's meaningful to me that we had this chat. If people want to learn more about you and apparently Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, where would you like to direct them on the internet?
I guess to my Instagram site and my Twitter site. They're the same.
Yes.
Triumph ICD Insult Comic Dog HQ headquarters. Triumph ICD HQ.
Okay, I'll link to all that, and we'll keep an eye on those for future plans. And again, everyone, please, this holiday season, enjoy Leo on Netflix. It's remarkable, fun for the whole family, literally the whole family, every generation, I think. So, Robert Smigel, truly an honor. I hope you enjoyed this in some small way. And
I did.
I hope we talk again soon.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I hope so too. Thank you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
What can I say? That just meant the world. Robert Smigel, thank you so much for being on this show. I know it's not normally of the stature you're used to. sorry. I that was beautiful for me. I really enjoyed that, and it was nice to have him do his Arnold. Everyone does an Arnold. I think I started to do Bill Hader's Arnold when he was on Conan. We got to get out. There's a bomb in there. I do that, which isn't very strong. I'm doing Bill Hader's Arnold, so I didn't even indulge. But anyway, if you haven't checked out that Lost Hans and Franz podcast on Conan O'Brien, please do. Robert's great. Everyone's great. Robert's in it. Kevin Nealon, Dana Carvey, Conan, other cast members from Conan's universe. It's great. Anyway, Robert, thank you so much. Everyone else, this is the 829th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode on your podcast platform there that you've heard about, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. We're on social media. There's a Linktree link, hopefully, in the show notes that you can see. And if you click on that, you can find me and follow me on all the available social media platforms that I'm signed up for. I think I have to update that, actually. But yeah, but you know, if you want, I'm on Twitter and at Vish Creative, and on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna. Those are primary things. Started some of the other things like Blue Sky, but those are just developing, I suppose. Anyway, Linktree for all that stuff. Please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation that will keep this work I do going. It is getting to the point where I want that to be the show to be the primary pursuit in my life after years of trying to balance it with other work. And
I don't know if it's actually feasible. It's sometimes I feel like I just need like a wealthy benefactor or something, you know, or something like that. And but I have lots of great supporters on the Patreon, and $6 or more a month American. If you can afford that, you get exclusive content. You get episodes earlier than everybody else. But any amount is appreciated and helps me work. So if you like the work that goes into this show, thank you for supporting me on my Patreon. I appreciate that. Thanks again to the wonderful Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca, or visit their Edmonton and Calgary locations if you're in Alberta. I want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee and Granddad's Donuts for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks as always to my friend Jim Guthrie, a wonderful musician and a composer. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Robert Smigel, a true highlight for me in my career, frankly, let alone this show. So thank you to Robert. Thank you for subscribing to this podcast and following it and telling your friends all about it. Thank you for watching Leo on Netflix. Thank you for being you. I will talk to you very soon. Be well. Have a happy holiday. Bye for now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.